Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, welcome to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in, friends, to the NOLA Drink Show this week. Glad to have you here. Hope everybody's doing great out there. Got a really good show coming up for you here today. Talking with the team from MACNO, which is the Music and Culture Coalition of New Orleans. They're a fantastic nonprofit here in town that does advocacy work and a policy work geared towards protecting and advocating for culture bearers in New Orleans. And that means, working with musicians a lot, to a certain extent, working with the service and hospitality industry. And really what it's all about is making sure that those that generate the raw material, if you will, of our tourism economy, which is, of course, culture, those people see benefits from the tourism economy. There's a lot of disconnects there, and some of it may seem obvious, some of it may seem not so obvious about how so many folks that really are the lifeblood of New Orleans in so many ways, including our tourist economy, our tourism economy, which, as we've noted numerous times on this show, really is the heart of the economy of the city of New Orleans, but how a lot of these folks really don't see benefits from it. And there's a lot of disconnect there, actually. And so we'll be talking with the team from MACNO, as I said, talking about some of those issues, maybe bringing to you some ideas and things that you haven't thought of as it relates to what I just described, but also talking about some of the restructuring of the tourism organizations here in town. And the idea, the upshot, we'll talk about it during the interview, but the upshot is that due to the restructuring, there may be some resources to move around. And the idea has been proposed by the mayor here, Mayor Cantrell, here in New Orleans, to create a so-called culture fund at about $3.9 million. That's the proposed figure at this point. Great idea on paper, but there's a lot of lack of clarity, I'll put it that way, at this point, about what that fund means and who actually will receive the benefits from the fund. And MACNO, of course, is deeply entrenched in the conversation and advocating to make sure that those who do actually produce the culture see the lion's share of the benefits from it. Really, really fascinating conversation. If you are, from the area, a lot of this probably makes sense to you and you understand why it's important. If you're from outside the area, you may go, well, why is this important? Or do I really want to hear this? Well, if you like New Orleans, if you love New Orleans, if you visit New Orleans, if you plan on visiting New Orleans, this really matters to you because this is why you come to New Orleans, is to enjoy our hospitality, our food, our music scene, and so much of that sort of stuff, our culture. That's what we're selling. That's what we're exporting to you. That's what we're using to convince you to come and pay us a visit. And we need to make sure, we need to ensure that those that help create the culture, those that do create the culture, are seeing just benefits from it and from our tourism economy. So that's our conversation today. Programming note for next week, I'm really excited to bring back, our French Quarter Fest series, something we've been doing for about a year and a half. We partner up with our good friends at French Quarter Festival. As I always say, in my opinion, the finest music festival on the planet. Happens April 16th through the 19th this year. And it's 23 stages this year that'll be peppered, as it always is, throughout the French Quarter, free to attend. It's also a fantastic food festival. All kinds of local restaurants are out there, kind of scattered, also peppered throughout the quarter, serving up some really good food that you can purchase. And it is a very, very fine festival. As I mentioned, it's free to attend and check out the music. And it all focuses on local with the food. It all focuses on local with the music. It is easily the finest showcase. There's no question about that. The finest showcase of Louisiana music that you're going to find anywhere. And it is just such a neat event on so many different levels. But our French Quarter Fest series, what we do is we pull in musicians who are performing at the festival. And we talk about their music, of course. We talk about their connection to food and drink, which, as you can imagine, is very easy here in New Orleans. We talk about what it means to perform at French Quarter Fest. And we talk about other things, preserving our culture, sort of like today's show. A lot of what we talk about is making sure the next generation is being nurtured in the pipeline for creating music here in New Orleans, aspects of education, aspects of resources, similar to what we will talk about today. Often we touch on things, how it's so important to support our musicians here because of what they mean to all of us. Really excellent series. As I mentioned, we partner up with our friends at French Quarter Festival to bring you this. If you're interested in checking out more about the festival, go check out FrenchQuarterFest.org. And I also want to highlight the fact that we also partner to do this series with our good friends at Louisiana Music Factory, the finest record store on the planet, located at 421 Frenchman Street. That's where we always tape these interviews. So go check them out because they are cultural bearers themselves. They are the finest purveyor of local music, really support local musicians, making sure that if they're releasing CDs, albums independently, for example, that they are available in their store. They do a lot of great stuff for local musicians as well. And it's an honor to partner with both of our sets of friends there at French Quarter Fest Series and at Louisiana Music Factory. That's next week's show, friends. So be sure to tune in for that one. We're going to take a little break here on the program, and then we're going to be back talking with the team from Macno. Come on back. They say le bon temps brûlé. Hey, Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. From the city that shares a deep connection to bourbon and knows how to throw a party comes the 4th Annual New Orleans Bourbon Festival from March 11th through the 14th. Discover over 150 bourbons and American whiskeys, as well as great food, all at the Grand Tasting. Check out more than 30 seminars led by industry luminaries, special distiller dinners, and much, much more. The event is brought to you by Beam Suntory, Four Roses, Brown Foreman, Uncle Nearest, and the Hilton Riverside. More info and tickets at nobourbonfest.com. All right, everybody, welcome back to the program. Brian Diaz here. Thanks for listening to NOLA Drink Show, friends, this week. I do appreciate it, as always. And yeah, we're here at Two Jags, the second oldest restaurant here in New Orleans on Decatur Street, and we are talking with the team from Macno, which is the music and cultural... Ethan, say it for me, because I stumble over this every time.
Man. You and everyone. So the Music and Culture Coalition of New Orleans.
Okay, thank you very much. I always want to... I can't remember if it's culture or cultural, but it's culture. We're going to call it Macno for the sake of... my sanity during the broadcast.
And brevity, too.
And brevity, that's good. But we're chatting, thank you, chatting with the team from Macno, and as you've heard already, Ethan Ellestad, who's the executive director. Welcome back to the show, man.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Absolutely. And we're joined by a couple other team members, too. Hannah Krieger-Benson, who is in programming for Macno. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah, that's right. Programming and research.
Programming and research. Yeah. Awesome. And Renard Bridgewater, who is the community engagement coordinator. Renard, how you doing?
I'm pretty well. How about yourself?
I'm doing well, man. Thanks for making time. I really appreciate it, all three of you joining us. And we're talking about, I want to talk a little bit about what Macno does. And actually, why don't we frame it that way first? Can you guys just, somebody give me the 30-second, 1 minute, you know, what is Macno that we all need to know?
Well, I think you should go since you were there first,
right.
The very first meeting.
Perfect.
So Macno is a seven and a half year old organization that deals with all the ways that law and policy impact music and culture. So it's kind of a non-intuitive intersection in that way, but it's a lot of different stuff that overlaps. So it's a lot of things like zoning law and noise ordinance and street performers' rights and basically making sure that our legal system on paper in this city matches up with the cultural landscape that we all love and want to nurture.
Okay, great. And so advocacy, policy work, mm-hmm. stuff like that, right? Is that? And I think it's important, friends, if you're listening, that you understand this, and part of what we're talking about here today is that the culture that we sell here in New Orleans to visitors and locals alike, that's the fuel that fuels the economy here, and making sure that there's equality, inclusion, and other aspects and support for that culture is really important, right? Is that a mm-hmm. fair way to put it?
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we've had a bit of a situation here in the city, and we won't go too far down this road, y'all, because I don't want to be overly technical, but we've had two entities One called the New Orleans Tourism and Marketing Corporation, and then the artist, as I like to say, formerly known as the Convention and Visitors Bureau, now called New Orleans and Company, that are now being restructured and merging. But can any of you want to explain kind of briefly what those agencies are and then what this all means as they restructure and then this cultural fund potentially being created as a result?
Sure. So, you know, they are the two entities, and there were two entities, now that, as you said, combining into one that really were involved in marketing the city for tourism purposes. So outward facing, how do we get more people to come to New Orleans? How do we get more infrastructure for the people to that visit to enjoy? And then, you know, how do we make more money off of tourism, I think is the most succinct way to say it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they really were sort of a PR firm, largely, and two of them that really worked on sort of, as I said, as a marketing firm to bring more people. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's as simple as it gets.
Sure. And so it tied into stuff, right? Selling conventions and
right.
selling wedding parties and all of that kind of stuff. But then it was the outward, as you said, marketing image of the city that we sell to like run tourism commercials in other markets, right?
Right. And then there was a third entity that still exists, which deals specifically with the convention center, which of course works, you know, in tandem with the other agencies as well.
Mm-hmm. So now when it was the New Orleans Tourism and Marketing Corporation, that's a city entity, right? That's a government entity. And whereas the Convention and Visitors Bureau, or now New Orleans and Company, is actually a private non-profit, right?
Correct. I think it might be a public-private partnership, but it essentially works as a private entity.
Okay.
And New Orleans and Company was more public. There were council members on the board. There was a way to interact with leadership there. There was some accountability, fiscal and sort of via public pressure, because you had elected officials on it, so they were going to be somewhat responsive. Whereas New Orleans and Company is, as I said, fairly private, and so has meetings that are less accessible, hard to figure out exactly what they're doing, less accountability for funding, but they receive a lot of money and mm-hmm. a lot of money through tax revenue, a lot of the hotel tax revenue. So every time you stay somewhere, a little piece of that is taxed, which then goes back into the coffers of, in some places, as the city's general fund. Here, largely that tax goes back into the banks of the tourism marketing entities.
Mm-hmm.
And so the money cycles through, a lot of it never touches the city or, you know, benefits the infrastructure. In fact, it benefits the same people marketing it. So it's sort of a cycle.
A self-rewarding cycle.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, Renard, let me ask you this question, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but how are we are we having a disconnect here with who is so the money, as we're describing, going back to these organizations? A lot of what these organizations, as I see it, are doing is we're selling the culture of New Orleans as to why you want to come here.
Right.
People have to create that culture. How are we misconnecting this then?
I think we're misconnected, and it's something that we've definitely, you know, publicly spoken about for a long time. It's just about the extractive nature of those entities, instead of the money that's generated, those tax dollars coming back to those individuals that create the culture and continuously have been perpetuating it for decades, if not centuries, it's not going to them. So, you know, where just a quick example, where you have a black masking Indian who spends thousands of dollars in feathers and, you know, various other items to sew a suit. They don't make any of that money back, in addition to having to work a day job or potentially not even mask and suit up for their cultural tradition and being able to, you know, wear a suit during Mardi Gras, because they have to pick and choose. Do I pay rent or do I sew and wear a suit?
Right.
You know?
And we're putting that group right in front of everybody, in front of
exactly.
the cameras, in front of the tourists,
correct.
Right, and all that.
Right.
Well, how about, can we, and I think for people listening outside the area, so we're talking about the Mardi Gras Indian tradition, and a lot of people out there are probably familiar with it, but maybe we can use this as an example. Let's talk about second lines a little bit, because that's something that we like to sell mm-hmm. these days to tourists and such, because now every time somebody has a milestone birthday or they come to town for a wedding, it is often now part of the whole fandango, right? And, you know, second lines are time and money and performance.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And there's a difference between the traditional second lines on Sundays and what you see,
absolutely.
You know, parading on the French Quarter for multiple times per day at this point. And the tourism, one of the tourism entities did a second line for the Friends Couch, which got some sort of local outrage going because, you know, at that point, calling it a second line doesn't make it a second line. Really, they're just doing a little parade. Right. But marketing as a second line, and you know, of course, the band got paid, right? And I guess that's good, but that's not enough. Because you have these traditional second lines, which is, you know, a well over a century old tradition that goes on Sundays, that there are a lot of costs involved. There are city permits, there are police escorts. You've got they have little floats, some of them, right? There's everyone sort of got, sort of the outfit they wear one time that they've got to pay for, et cetera. But again, all those costs, as Renard was saying, come out of pocket. Mm-hmm. And so while the city is marketing a quote unquote second line and you know, getting all this money coming in, making it sort of a tool to bring people here, the people that originated those traditions aren't getting any of those fees paid for. It still become, you know, can be still cost prohibitive for them. And one thing that, you know, we talk about a little bit is we're making all this money. It shouldn't be that much of a logical leap to say, like, let's subsidize the fees for the people that originated the tradition that are keeping it alive, that mm-hmm. are actually bringing the money in.
So maybe we're suggesting this idea that if you're going to do this for your wedding, which is, like you're noting, Ethan, thank you, that's not the traditional second line. But if you're going to do that, then portion of the revenue that you would pay, say, maybe through the permit to the city, would then go back to the actual cultural bearers and cultural creators.
Yeah.
And I also just want to point out that the sort of the wedding second line thing that has grown over the last, you know, couple of decades is in some ways not even the most problematic example, because that's often a band getting directly paid. Mm-hmm. There's even layers on top of that, like, you know, talking about black masking Indians, and, you know, if the tourism infrastructure hires a photographer to take pictures of black masking Indians in the street, and the photographer is making money, and then they're selling those images, and, you know, there's this sort of, or, you know, a tour guide, maybe, you know, from a private touring company is sort of selling the experience of, oh, I'll bring you to the second line, and then they're making money. So, in other words, the more sort of, you know, when you're talking about the misconnect, I feel like the opposite of that, or the way to solve that, is to sort of make it the most direct. And in that way, I just wanted to point out that the wedding second line is not actually even the worst offender, because then bands are directly making money, which is incredibly important. But like you said, then if the fees to the city then could also maybe be directed toward things like infrastructure for culture bearers and working class New Orleanians, that would sort of be the additional level.
So. Okay, great. What would you all say, I mean, in maybe... Let's pick one or two. We're going to take a break in about 3-4 minutes. You guys, but we have plenty of time to chat. I wanted to bring up the second lines because people have heard of it, and it serves as an example of taking something and tweaking it, for lack of a better way to put it, or distorting it, and then people not getting properly compensated or recognized for it. But what would be, as you said, Hannah, what would be something that would be more egregious that maybe we're not paying attention to, or maybe we are, but it's not being dealt with on a multi-layered way that we're talking about here?
I guess one of the big ones is images of culture bearers being used on billboards and whatnot. And, you know, historically there's been a lot of issues around copywriting Indian suits, in terms, you know, copyrights of imagery, sort of who owns that image. And, you know, like Renard's talking about, it's these sort of incredible, unique works of art. So I think the image and the photography question is a really big one, because images are often what sell. And, you know, if you're hiring a photographer but not compensating the subjects, which is historically often what has happened, then that's, I think, a pretty good example of that disconnect. So.
That's a really good example. Did you want to add to that?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to add, I mean, since we're talking about second lines, one of the main observations that I make, and I'll combine the point into two. One, originally, you know, and something that I continuously harp on in regards to second lines is that this was a tradition that was started out of benevolent societies where, you know, black individuals, black New Orleanians in various communities were not given the opportunity to buy life insurance by their white counterparts. And out of that, they formed the Associate and Pleasure Clubs, originally called Benevolent Societies, to be able to, you know, collect a pot of money and then take that money and then be able to cover those funeral services. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, in addition to, I just find it's always very interesting to watch second lines now, or the ones, the ones that we see taking place with the various conventions, because these people don't look like they're having fun. And I think one of the most important things about a second line, right, with me being born and raised here and taking part of those cultural traditions since I was a child, and, you know, footwork and, you know, street vendors and just having a good time with people in your community and neighborhood, the majority of the second lines that I see going down St. Peter's or Bourbon or Royal, like, they're not enjoying themselves.
Right.
It's almost like their feet hurt. I'm a little confused.
Do you feel like it's like it's something that you're being made to do?
Yeah, it's almost like they're forced to do it as a part of the agenda for the convention. Uh-huh. It's like, you know. So.
Well, let's do this, you guys. Let's take a little break here on the show, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about some of these issues and the proposed idea for a cultural fund and get to know a little bit more about what MACNO does, too. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on. Welcome back to the show, Brian Diaz. Thanks for listening to the NOLA Drink Show, friends. As always, thanks to our friends here at 2JAGS, as usual, for hosting us today. And we are chatting with the team from MACNO, Ethan, Hannah, and Renar. And we're talking about some changes in the tourism funding, cultural funding landscape here in New Orleans. We framed the issue. We can obviously talk for hours about a lot of this stuff. But what now, y'all, is being proposed as NOTMC merges, New Orleans Tourism Marketing Corporation merges with New Orleans and Company, are you with me, that there's going to be some resources potentially. And the proposal from the mayor at this point is to create a so-called cultural fund at maybe $3.9 million. That's the figure.
Yeah, we can say $4 million. I think that's
okay. Can we round up? We're going MACNO and $4 million. Yeah. All right, right on.
see if we can get a, you know, put the bug in their ear to just round it up.
Oh yeah, I like that idea. So we're doing a little fundraising here too. So we bounce that another 100G right there. That's cool. So the idea, if somebody want to explain this, is that we're gonna have this fund, and this is where these things can be very exciting on one hand, and especially here in New Orleans, probably pretty damn scary on another hand, because identifying where that money needs to go or where that money should go. And I think we've touched on that a bit.
Yeah, I can go through that a little bit. So yeah, the proposal is something, and this is something we've called for and a lot of organizations have, which is to take some of the tourism tax revenue and redirect it directly to, you know, the cultural community, which is, you know, and I think the issue is like that's a little bit gray, right? What is the cultural community? Who gets it? What qualifies or what doesn't? That is all sort of an open question. And so, you know, we think that money should be going directly to, you know, the grassroots spots, the people that are really sort of the backbone of the culture, who generally get the least resources and are often the businesses and organizations that are struggling the most day to day, are often sort of the most culturally vibrant places. And so how can we use that as a reinvestment tool to really prop up that back end of the people that are there day to day that really could use these resources? You know, and the other question is, but also what else could qualify? You know, question, could the World War II Museum qualify? Maybe. And they don't need resources in the same way like the Backstreet Museum needs resources. And right, so right. How do we make sure that it is put that way? And I think, you know, I don't think it's so much scary as like we just need to make sure that it happens that way. There's, I think, a ton of good intentions and it's a great thing, but we just need to make sure that it's done right, because we may not get another shot for a while. So right. Let's make sure that it really goes where it's needed and can really multiply, right? I mean, I'm not huge into the economic theory, but, you know, investing in and multiplying that investment out, it seems like a great opportunity to do that as well.
Yeah, and spending at that grassroots level, that return on investment tends to be a little bit higher than when you're spending at the top of the pyramid.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah, and I think that that's important because, again, and I know we've touched on this, I don't think I can overemphasize this, that why people come to New Orleans and why people visit New Orleans is the culture. Mm-hmm. And we're taxing hotels or taxing visitors in different ways, and they're gaining the exposure to the culture, but the people that are creating the culture are not seeing the benefits from it.
Correct. And generally making, you know, less than a living wage, almost always making less than a living wage, you know, pay for a lot of musicians and bands hasn't gone up in decades. You know, the service industry workers make $2.13 an hour plus tips. You know, like, these aren't things you can live off of. And a small business, you know, where tourism based, often anything tourism, a small business that's tourism based is going to be dead often in the summer. Mm-hmm. And so anyone that's working at an hourly wage or working in gigs is going to have a slow season. So how do we make sure that that doesn't end up being what kills a business or an entity?
Right. And also let alone issues, right? Health insurance.
Yep.
Being able to pay your rent during slow season. Yep. We talked about that. We'll talk about this, I think, in the podcast only segment, a little bit about music venues. But music is obviously a huge part of the culture that we sell in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, guitars aren't cheap. Guitars get stolen, right?
Yeah. So yeah, that's. I guess we can talk a little bit about the ideas. You know, how can we use this? Great, we should give out grants to these small organizations and do all these things, but also, how do we make that investment? So one of the ideas that we've been putting out there is, why don't we have sort of an emergency fund for musicians, for culture bearers, for service industry workers? So if you get into some unexpected financial distress, there's a way out of it. You know, New Orleans floods, and people have apartments have flooded, and they've lost all of their gear. How do you get that back? Because now you've lost your way to make an income. So why don't we create a fund that can allow people to access that so you can get over that little hump?
Right. And the health insurance, the lack of health insurance as well, is also looking back over the crowdsourcing fundraising for musicians with serious medical problems, cancer and whatnot over the last, there's been sort of a noticeable spike in the last 5 or 8 years. And it's really striking and it's really sad. And, you know, the resources like that that can, you know, go towards sort of culturally specific things like gear and also towards sort of quality of life in that way.
Right. You know, we recently, and I don't want to go too far down this road, but we recently had a friend who's a bartender here in town who was hit on her bike. No health insurance. And when, you know, so you don't have health insurance and you also have no ability to earn a wage. So you're now, and this plays out for musicians, it plays out for people in the service industry, it plays out for a lot of workers that support those industries do not have those resources. And then when you, all of a sudden, the earning ability, the working ability stops, then you have no income whatsoever.
Yeah, now I would think, how many GoFundMes have we seen over the past couple of years of, say, somebody's touring van got stolen, right? Mm-hmm. And we've lost all of our gear, and we need to get to our gigs. This seems like an opportunity to have some resources to rectify that.
I think that's really good. And you guys put together a document. I know it's kind of a draft document, right? Is that fair to say, Renard, that it, about some ideas? Kind of spitballing, right, about things, where this money could go?
I mean, it's a draft of sorts. I mean, it's, you know, it's out in public now, you know, in what would you call, I guess, anti-gravity magazine. I mean, it's a publication, you know, so it's a draft of just spitballing and brainstorming various ideas that we thought would be able to help various cultural communities across the city in case of an emergency, like a flooding, damaged goods, instruments, studios, et cetera. So. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's out in the world. Steal them, man. You turn them into reality.
Please.
That's why it's out there. Yeah, to say, please do these things.
It's public domain for sure.
Yeah, and I dig it because you also asked for input, right?
Yes.
So it's definitely it's a work in progress for sure.
We'll make sure at the end of the next segment that we tell people out there how to, you know, get online with y'all, and if you have some good ideas that we all need, and get behind those good ideas. One of the ones that I thought was really cool, and you guys are going to take a break here in about 2.5 minutes, but the idea of maybe hiring a cultural planner as like a city office, a bureaucratic office, but somebody to kind of, it's not to plan, I like how you guys explained it, it's not to plan the culture, it's to coordinate and be able to actually effectively address these issues that the way this government structure now, it seems to be, just doesn't even click with.
Yeah, and so my background's in urban planning, so sort of that's sort of a ringer in there, right?
Oh, but, okay, got it.
but I think a lot of the issues in the thing come from it's not connected, it's not planned out. We don't have someone who just sits and says, like, how will this ordinance, how will this piece of zoning impact the culture of the city? And because that doesn't happen, we often get things sort of happenstance or things we get lost by attrition. Nobody thought it through how it might impact it. So something gets passed, and it turns out it wasn't thought out with, say, music in mind or a music venue in mind, and it doesn't allow it. It could have if someone would have stopped and said, hey, wait a minute, this, you know, decibel, say, just totally random, say decibel levels must be below 60, which is not something that exists, but it's just hypothetical.
Yeah.
That would mean that generally you couldn't have live music. So whoever proposed that wouldn't maybe have known that, and no one flagged it, and it could have gotten passed into law.
Right.
So something like that.
So now we're saying, like, a lot of these decisions are being made from one angle, and it's kind of tunnel vision?
Yeah, one angle, or just not looking at the whole picture.
Yeah.
It's say you're passing an ordinance based on one business, but when you pass that ordinance based on one business, it affects every business. And then what you thought was a small piece turns into a really big problem.
Right. Got it.
And a lack of inclusivity, too. Yeah. You know, I think something that we've seen within our work over the past several years that's been happening before the organization, for sure, is where you have policy initiatives that are directly affecting your service industry workers, your cultural practitioners, your musicians and artists, and they're brought into that process after the policy draft has already been created, compared to at the beginning. And then they have to, you know, once they present that document or ordinance or whatever it is to those individuals, then you're seeing a situation where those people are saying, well, I can't relate to this. How, you know, what do I do with this? And then they have to scrap it and go back to square one, mm-hmm. when they could have just avoided all those steps by going to those people to begin with.
Just like I was saying at the beginning, you know, at the intersection of culture and policy, I think a lot of people don't think of those things as intersecting. And that's kind of the problem, is that there's that, you know, it's not, culture is not something that's seen as a force to shape policy. An example I use is that for years the City Planning Commission has had an environmental expert. You know, one of the people on that body is an environmental expert because that's recognized as a thing that should be driving policy. But there's never been a cultural expert because that was never recognized.
Exactly.
You know, and so like Renard is saying, you know, best case scenario is that they write something that's sort of not relevant or not useful and it gets scrapped. But sometimes, you know, things are written that are actually going to do harm to the culture and the cultural community if they get passed. And then we have to sort of be vigilant. But that could all be circumvented if it was woven into the process.
Yeah. Proper stakeholder representation, mm-hmm. from the beginning, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's classic policymaking, or what you should do.
And I think the idea is, you know, culture often just sort of happens, but it doesn't happen in a vacuum. And so often is, how do we create spaces that allow culture to grow and continue? And that doesn't mean we're going to make sure that music happens here, 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 and here. It is, let's have a policy that allows music to happen where it would happen. And that's really the key, mm-hmm. right? And I think everybody's been saying is exactly right. We need an expert. We need to bring in people on the front end that are from the cultural community. And that's what a cultural planner could really do for the city.
Awesome. Well, let's do this, you guys. Let's take a little break here on the show. We're going to come back and chat more with the team from MACNO. Come on back.
Laissez le bon temps brûler. Hey, Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. From the city that shares a deep connection to bourbon and knows how to throw a party, comes the 4th Annual New Orleans Bourbon Festival from March 11th through the 14th. Discover over 150 bourbons and American whiskeys, as well as great food, all at the Grand Tasting. Check out more than 30 seminars led by industry luminaries, special distiller dinners, and much, much more. The event is brought to you by Beam Suntory, Four Roses, Brown Foreman, Uncle Nearest, and the Hilton Riverside. More info and tickets at nobourbonfest.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here. Thanks for listening in. We are chatting with Ethan, Hannah, and Reynard from MACNO, and talking about really important cultural impacts and dynamics and things maybe you don't necessarily realize when you experience and interface with the culture here in New Orleans, those who provide it and those who are benefiting from it. And one of the important topics that has really been going on for quite a while here, but it's become a hot button issue, I guess it's fair to say, lately, talking about street performers. And we might take street performers, I guess, for granted because they are all over certain neighborhoods of New Orleans. But Renard, if you want to jump in here, there's a lot of threats to street performers, and it's part of the fabric of our culture here.
Correct. I mean, I think one of the main issues that we have dealt with a lot when it comes to street performance is, one, misinformation. Secondly, the amount of law enforcement that interact daily and regularly with street performers. 9 different law enforcement agencies all telling those street performers 9 different things can be very difficult to, you know, put into practice when you're just out there trying to, you know, substantiate your financial livelihood and be able to keep yourself afloat, so to speak. So I think those are the two main things, and they work in tandem, right? When that misinformation is being given by several different agencies. You know, and then something that we've been dealing with very recently is the Royal Street Pedestrian Mall, where, you know, as a result of the Hard Rock collapse, Royal Street is now open to traffic, where on a regular daily basis throughout the week, I believe 11 to 5.
I think it's 11 to 4, right?
11 to 4, yeah. And 11 to 5 on weekends.
11
to 7 on weekends. See, even more time to be able to busk on the streets of New Orleans. But they are no longer allowed to legally do that because of the traffic being open. And that's something once again, there was no information given to those individuals out there. So, you know, a normal day at work, you're coming out there prior to 11 a.m. to perform, and then you're getting into a situation with a police officer or a, you know, private patrol man or woman that's saying you're not allowed to be here, and, you know, they never got the memo. So, mm-hmm.
And that's an important part, right? And we talked about this before, that, you know, it's a public safety thing, right, because of the Hard Rock, so it's creating further access for emergency vehicles and stuff. So the we don't have to debate whether that's super legit or not, but, you know, it's public safety, and that's fine. But as you said, Renard, the people didn't get the memo. You're messing with people's livelihoods at that point.
Correct.
And it's also a group, right, that can be easily marginalized and easily sort of, no pun intended, run over.
Yeah.
Truly.
Very.
Yeah, and one, you know, we were contacted by a band that plays out there regularly and said since they've reopened it to traffic, you know, at least permanently for now, I guess, is the best way to say it. They haven't been able to play out there, and so the gigs they do, a lot of the clubs don't pay enough. They need that to supplement their income, and so to put them in financial difficulty.
Yeah.
And they weren't able to plan for it, and so people are contacting them saying, hey, we came out to see you play and you weren't there. What's happening? We traveled to New Orleans and wanted to see you. Mm-hmm. Were part of our experience. Where are you? And that's a real problem, right? With notice, they could make income and they could let people know.
Mm-hmm. And it's sort of that's touching on this issue that it's sort of at the whim of all these different law enforcement agencies or city government. There's this kind of sense that street performers are just sort of subject to everybody else's whims and have sort of no rights. You know, like you said, they're very easily marginalized. There's a lot of us like really negative assumptions that go along. Like some of the conversations that we've pushed back on over the years around street performers will, you know, include street performers in like lists of health nuisances that the health department deals with. And like, there's just sort of this lack of regard for their, you know, human dignity and also their cultural dignity. And just for anybody who's sort of not familiar, the pedestrian mall on Royal Street was passed by legislation in 1971. In other words, this isn't just about sort of the whim of you know, whichever law enforcement agency is there. Those barricades are legally, you know, mandated to be put out 11 to 4 and 11 to 7 on weekends to block off the street to create that space for people to perform, and for that to just sort of go away without the due legal process. You know, it is actually really problematic in a legal sense as well, because it's kind of acting as though, you know, the legal infrastructure around street performing that's supposed to nurture it just doesn't matter. And it's that reflection of it being just so marginalized and so much an afterthought and sort of collateral damage.
But, and I would also challenge everyone to go then look at all of, as we talk about the tourism agencies, go look at the pages for Royal Street, go look at their Twitter accounts and see how many times people busking on Royal Street pop up. They're the headlining image, right, often. And so
when you're watching national sporting broadcasts from here,
Who's out there? Right, sure. Somebody playing. So we're selling it, but then we're not protecting the livelihoods of the people that are creating what we're selling. And you can go today, and I will almost guarantee you within the last week, you will have seen the tourism agencies tweeting out pictures of people busking on Royal Street.
Yeah,
but they can't do it right now. So why haven't we resolved that or compensated the people for that?
Right. And that you know what, and I don't want to go too far down this road either, y'all, but I think, and I don't want to put a value on one street performer over another, but I think what a lot of people don't understand here is how many people that are musicians that you have heard of now that started out busking on places like Royal Street. Mm-hmm. And a pipeline that we have for cultural creation and music in particular in this city is somebody starts busking on Royal Street and then they move into a club, or somebody who's an established musician takes them under their wing and mm-hmm. puts them in their band. And we have a lot of people that now produce records and tour the world that 15, 20 years ago were playing on that street.
Yep.
It is a cultural pipeline.
It's an incubator. It's a network. It's a way to hone your craft and, you know, meet people and rehearse. And, you know, it's so important.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you guys, let's do this because we got about 2 minutes left before we have to close out the radio portion of the show. Tell people how can we connect with MACNO and, you know, get involved.
Yeah, I mean, MACNO.com is definitely going to be one of the quickest ways to do that, our official website.
MACCNO.
You got it.
Okay.
Facebook is MACNO page, MACCNO page, PAGE. Twitter and Instagram are both Music Culture 504, the numbers. So
cool.
Yeah.
And you guys accept donations?
We yeah. certainly do. Yes. We encourage them. Actually. Right.
Thankful, gracious, all those yeah. things.
We are a nonprofit, so you know everything is tax deductible. There's a donate link on our webpage. Easiest to find. If you have questions, you can always contact us via email at mailings@macno.com, and we can answer any question you might have.
That's great. I appreciate it, you guys. So what we're going to do here, and actually, really quickly, 30 seconds, can you do GoFundMe page to support the artists in Jackson Square?
Yeah, so in the news, so there was a tragedy in which you know a lot of the work was destroyed for artists in Jackson Square, and a lot of people lost their livelihoods. There's currently a GoFundMe page that is out. It's on our social media. We'll pin it to the top so people can find it. I believe it is called Help Jackson Square Artists Recover. So we're raising money, helping them raise money to get their gear back, get artist supplies back so they can restart their way of living.
Awesome. Very cool. And I will be. You will also find it in our show notes and find it on our social media as well. So just go look there as well. What we're going to do, these guys are going to stick around for another shot with Nola Drinks. We're going to continue the conversation. I think we're going to talk about the confusion that is the world of music venues here in New Orleans. This could be a multi-episodic thing, probably. But we'll try and boil it down to a succinct 15 minutes for you, if that's possible. So, friends, if you are listening on the radio, remember to be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until next time, cheers, y'all. Everybody, up another shot with Nola Drinks. Friends, hope you are enjoying this conversation here with Ethan, Hannah, and Renard from Macno. We're about to bounce right back over to Two Jags to continue the conversation. We're going to talk a little bit about the confusing world of music permitting and music venue permitting in New Orleans and why it matters to you. Here we go. Yep, another shot with Nola Drinks. Thanks for listening in, friends, as always. Thanks to Two Jags here, the second oldest restaurant in New Orleans, established in 1856. They are always gracious enough to host us from time to time when we do the show. And we are chatting with the team from Macno minus one. Renard had real work to do instead of spending his time talking with me. but Ethan and Hannah were kind enough to stick around for this segment. And we were talking about this, y'all, during one of the breaks. Another thing that maybe you don't really realize, we have a lot of music in New Orleans, right? Everybody knows that. That's why a lot of people come here. But there is a very confusing process. We talked about street performers, but a very confusing process for music venues, right? It's not just like throw up a stage and book band. It's a little more complicated than that in a lot of ways, right?
Well, you can throw up a stage and book a band, but the question is what does the city classify you as at that point, as a building, okay, as a right. business, as a use? Okay.
And how long and if they will allow it to continue.
Right.
So now let's maybe we frame it this way. If I were to acquire a building and I threw up a stage and I booked a band, what might I be faced with? That was a loaded question, sorry.
A headache. You'd be faced with a headache.
Yes, correct.
Hours and hours and hours sitting at City Hall trying to go from one office to the other and being told three different answers?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And a long process before you even got the approval to start anything. I mean, and who knows who knows when that actually happened. You'd have to do an engagement process. You'd have to formally meet with neighbors. You'd have to go to the city planning commission. You'd have to get approval from city council.
And it depends what where you are in the city, because the thing about zoning is that it's very, very, you know, there's a lot of different designations, and, you know, it's any given neighborhood is divided up into, you know, sort of sub-designations, and it, so it really depends kind of where you're at.
Okay. And do you plan to sell alcohol? And is your building 300 feet from a church? Because if you're planning on selling alcohol and having live music, you can't have a live performance venue, but you can have a restaurant or a hotel that has music and alcohol, but not everything. And so there's a lot of... And if you get approval of 70% of the property owners within 300 feet of that church, then you can have sell alcohol and have live music. So there's a lot of things that
and that's property you. Owners, not residents.
Correct. So you might have to track down somebody in Florida that just bought a spot, turn into an Airbnb, and get his approval to open up your business, even though you might have lived in the neighborhood 20 years. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a lot of intricacies that really can trip people up and make and put in a barrier to opening a lot of these businesses. If you have deep pockets, it's much more likely you'll be able to open up a spot and have music than if you are someone who's from the community who kind of worked their way up and is trying to do a real sort of small grassroots
business. Somebody who just wants to put up a stage and book bands at a spot that's in their neighborhood that's, you know, in close proximity to them and their neighbors and their friends and, you know, sort of embedded in the community. So it's, yeah, there's a lot of challenges.
Well, and so let's frame it this way a little bit, because I think, okay, we're talking about it, say, from a permitting or right. owner perspective, right, which is confusing enough. And if you live in New Orleans, then we probably don't need to explain that to you, no matter what business you do. but from the sake of a cultural standpoint, then, you know, what are some of the implications of that? Venues to play, places where you might get paid, right? But it's complicated beyond that, isn't it?
It is. So I think one thing that sort of sums it up for me is the easiest place to open up a music venue is in a hotel. And that seems really telling.
Right.
It's almost impossible to do it in a neighborhood. Even though we talk about the importance of neighborhoods and culture, it's virtually impossible to open up a new neighborhood bar. It's virtually impossible to open up a quote-unquote music venue. You might be able to have a small restaurant and have a little bit of music. But to have a spot where you just want to have a drink and see a show... really difficult in some of the neighborhoods where the culture came from, significantly easier in the central business district.
I'm going to expand on that in two ways. One is, you know, if anybody's not familiar, the historical importance of neighborhood music venues. I mean, they're a phenomenon that really cannot be sort of overestimated if we're talking about, again, you know, kind of like the Royal Street Pedestrian Mall is an incubator. Neighborhood venues are the incubator, and it's kind of the same thing. It's the rhythmic rhythm of it, in terms, you know, week to week and month to month, it's a place where maybe you have the same people playing, you know, every Wednesday is the same band for, you know, many years, and it's that kind of thing, which, you know, having all these impediments and obstacles to opening new neighborhood venues, you know, like Ethan says, it's really telling, and that is what is at stake and at risk of harm is all of these sort of the cultural practices that, you know, can flourish in those spaces and really can't flourish without them.
Yeah, and to me, the pathway that sums it up really well is, you know, the band Galactic, which sort of got their start in a bar called Benny's, which it closed long before I got here, but, you know, it was a really neighborhood spot. With a lot of stories you can find out about it. I've read some of them, right? It was, but, you know, a late night spot and just sort of people come in and just be able to play. And, you know, Galactic got their start, grew, you know, sort of create a big profile and have a lot of success. And then when Tipitina's was in trouble, they were able to step in and buy Tipitina's and make sure that legacy keeps going. And that is sort of the pathway we keep saying should be happening. It's unfortunately not very common, but had there not have been that small little spot that no longer exists, you might not have Tipitina's could have closed when they got in financial trouble.
Right. Well, and many bands have the place that was their incubator. And sometimes it's, you know, a sort of music venue. Sometimes it's a little bit looser. You know, sometimes it was sort of a bar where they all happened to be regulars and they would, you know, meet and songwrite in the back room, whatever. But most places or most bands, I feel like, have at least one incubator. You know, I've played music in town for about 12 years. And, you know, even I have places that have been my incubators and just sort of recognize, and a lot of them have been sort of places embedded in neighborhoods. So I feel like that is just so important, you know, the fact that it's almost impossible to embed new music spaces in neighborhoods. And what happens is the culture then drains out of the neighborhoods into the main corridors, into the main arteries, you know, the main big street maybe running nearby, because that's sort of how zoning often plays out, is it kind of, and you can't undo it. You can't roll that back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead, Ethan.
I'm saying that that's really the crux of it, is once everything sort of gets pushed out, you can't turn back the clock and say, you know, this was a venue 30 years ago and it was famous, so we're going to reopen. And even if you go through all that process and someone miraculously get it reopened as a music venue, all of the things that happened there and, you know, have left. And that magic isn't going to be recaptured in the same way. Maybe something new will happen. That would be great. But, you know, likely it might become a tourism draw or something, or everyone will sort of have a reverence for what was, but a lot of the creativity and the spark will have left.
That's really well said, and that's a point that we've said it here basically, but just to kind of summarize maybe, is that most of the music that we enjoy in New Orleans that we share with the world is not created in the neighborhood in which we are sitting, the French Quarter, right now. Mm-hmm. And there, I want to be fair because I kind of pick on the French Quarter sometimes. There is a lot of culture in the French Quarter, indigenous French Quarter culture. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the music that we truly enjoy, I mean, most of the old school jazz guys that we all know and love, you know, their houses, and a lot of them are still standing and not protected, are in Central City, for example, or in places like the Treme, where the music really does come from, and having the neighborhood, using your term, Hannah, incubator bars, where kids can grow up around that tradition, learn how to play music, and play in a venue in your neighborhood that then maybe puts you on a different trajectory, I think really matters.
It really has to do with accessibility at all levels, because it's having the spaces that are accessible to the neighbors and the neighborhood and the neighborhood kids and the all of that, and then also having pathways that are accessible to people who want to open new spots, and having, you know, it really just all has to do with accessibility and obstacles to that. And, you know, like Ethan said, deep pockets can overcome a lot of obstacles, but deep pockets are not where culture comes from.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, how about this? Let me ask you guys this question real quick, and then we'll wrap it up. And I know we could talk about this forever, too. We were talking earlier about policy making and maybe not good policy making when bringing in all the stakeholders required to talk about something. And so this was in the news, you know, 6 months ago, and it's an ongoing issue. Outdoor music performance. it sounds simple enough, doesn't it?
And we laugh because it sounds simple, and this is incredibly weirdly complex, secretive decision making that has really sort of is the best example of how policy gets in the way of culture.
So frustrating.
And to sum it up briefly is without going too far in the weeds, about 6 months ago, there was some debate around outdoor music. And it turns out it was uncovered during that time that the Department of Safety and Permits had essentially said that no new business can have outdoor music at all citywide. And they said that because in the zoning code, there's a provision that says to have live entertainment, you must have your doors and windows closed during a performance. And their reasoning was there are no doors and windows to close outside, therefore there can be no live performances outside at any business, because how could you close something that doesn't exist? Which is counter. Well, we could also, I suppose, build a freestanding window and close it, and perhaps then...
Oh, I knew someone who said she was going to put a window frame on a stick and march it around in, you know, in courtyards. just to clarify, you know, for anybody listening, the specific thing we're talking about does not include outdoor-based, like street-based cultural practices like parades and masking Indians and whatnot.
It's like if you have like a courtyard in the back.
Yeah, right? It's outdoor music within zoned spaces, which is not public space, not the streets. It's within buildings.
And it's not house parties either, although that's got a different set of regulations.
Yeah.
But you can still accomplish
specifically outdoor live music.
Which may not sound like a big deal, but that's a big deal in a lot of neighborhoods because that's what those venues are.
Well, and you know, this is one of those where the content was terrible in terms of, you know, restricting outdoor live music in this sort of very draconian, you know, just terrible way. But also the process was terrible, that nobody in the process stopped for a second and said, if there is a possibility that we can read the law this way, which, you know, leaving aside what we think of the legal interpretation, you know, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not going to speak to that, but if it is possible to read the law that way, the law needs to be rewritten.
Mm-hmm.
And this comes back to the sort of, you know, the laws on the books matching everybody saying, oh, we love our culture. Like, if you have a law on the books that could possibly be interpreted that way, even if it's by
Yeah, one neighbor can just litigate that and stop the whole thing short, right?
Right, which is, I mean, which is true of a lot of things, that laws can be weaponized by sort of people who have issues with cultural businesses, practices, people, and that happens a lot. And then, you know, it kind of came out that the process was absolutely insane and that there was sort of no written record of it, and that they said, you know, it was done by a sort of a verbal decision, but it was never documented.
No studies, no economic impact.
Right. Oh, no.
And someone just decided.
Cultural consultation.
Someone just decided. And it's the same thing, that absolutely not considering the impacts on culture. And then the Department of Safety and Permits came under federal investigation for corruption, which was just sort of an amazing, like...
It's an interesting coincidence that may or may not... I'll leave it at that. So
I didn't want to go down that road, but I'm just laughing.
No, but I think what's the thing that's really important and harkens back when we talked about the need for a cultural plan, and Hannah's explaining that exactly, right? Like, that's why. But also what Renard was talking about earlier with what happens with the Royal Street Pedestrian Mall is they didn't tell anybody. And just like this, they made this decision about outdoor music, and they didn't tell anybody until somehow it was uncovered. And, you know, I think we can take a lot of credit for uncovering it because we go through all these zoning documents, and like every time there's a proposed business with any cultural activity, we read the whole thing, and we found this little thing in there that said, you know, the safety and permits has said that this, whatever, that
in
this can't happen.
In 2015.
Right. Right. Yeah. What kind of, not just cultural practice, but what kind of business practice is it to make a decision and not tell any prospective business that they can or cannot do it? I mean, that's just terrible policy.
It's terrible policy. And it also sort of, again, reflects the lack of, you know, the fact that you know, and this is, you know, down, it's not just Macno, it's Ethan in particular is, you know, the one who reads these things and catches these things. And it's, you know, it's very, I mean, like I said, it's disconcerting that nobody else sort of officially in that process said, oh, wait a minute, this is the problem. And the fact that, you know, we have to sort of sit there and be vigilant about things is ridiculous, because that's, you know, I mean, like you said, that's not how policy should be.
I would like to not read all those things.
Right. Right. And it comes back to what I was saying.
It's not good nighttime reading, is
no.
it?
No. Well, it'll put you to sleep. But it comes back to what I was saying before, you know, the intersection of culture and policy, and the fact that a lot of people don't think about how those intersect, and people don't think of them as intersecting. And so, you know, it's sort of very dry and unsexy seemingly, but then it has these ridiculous and hard-hitting real-world consequences.
You go into the idea of, like, what is outdoor live entertainment? And it, even the way they've done it now, it's still easier for, like, a wedding venue to be open and have outdoor music by getting a special events permit, which is, again, as we talk about, access to capital in deep pockets. You can figure out a way around it and have a wedding venue that has outdoor live entertainment on some weekends. But if you're a small neighborhood spot that just wants to have, you know, a jazz brunch or a brass band once outdoor on weekends, that's cost prohibitive. You can't do it. And the second piece is, do you really want the Department of Safety and Permits determining what is cultural activity, what is live entertainment, and what is you know, traditional culture? I don't want the Department of Safety and Permits making that decision without any public accountability, with nobody that understands the culture on staff.
Yeah. Good
Me
point.
Neither.
Good point. And you guys, maybe we close here. To me, it's sort of doubling down on absurdity, right? There's this human cost that comes with this that are not being considered.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, people's, their livelihood. But then we're doubling down in the absurdity in that this is actually what we promote to sell
the main sector
of the economy in the city.
That's right.
I mean, literally, the idea that, you know, not to mention the fact that you can walk around in the streets with a drink is, you know, something that is a big sort of thrill, I think, to a lot of people who come here, because it's that sort of lack of restriction. It's the fluidity. And I know I'm originally from up north, the fluidity of indoor-outdoor space in New Orleans and in the sort of semi-tropical parts of the world is incredibly novel and appealing and fascinating. And, you know, a second line that goes through the streets and then stops at a bar and then goes back out. I mean, that fluidity of, like, you can be out in a courtyard. You know, I grew up in Boston. If you're inside, you are inside. If you're outside, you know it. Like,
right.
There's none of that fluidity in here. The idea that you could be sitting under an awning, but you're outside in a courtyard, and there's this band playing, and, like, you know, it's warm, and all of that. I mean, it literally is marketed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the opposition to live music in this particular case, you know, the City Planning Commission meeting was completely absurd. You know, the quote that stood out, well, two quotes. One was, you know, these people who were sort of pushing for these restrictions and saying, sometimes I can hear the happy sound of people having drinks, you know, from my backyard. As though this
God
was,
forbid.
You know, this was the worst possible thing. I mean, she literally said the happy sound, like the idea of, like, happiness was, and then the other one, someone said that they didn't want either a particular neighborhood or the city as a whole to devolve into a hellhole of live music.
Right. Which I just want to say, I don't think I've ever mentioned this. I've been doing research and the history of issues around music and performance in New Orleans. If you go to the old newspapers, you can do some searches that are amazing. And I found almost that exact quote, the hellhole of live music or something like that. I want to say from about 1913 or something like that.
Maybe he was quoting that. Maybe he was
verbatim,
you know.
Right? So that is where, you know, that's the same thing. But I think
why Storyville got raised.
Right? Essentially, right. I mean,
literally, like, yeah. And live music figured in that too. You know, there was issues where you couldn't have women and alcohol and live music. Like, live music has always been tied in with sin, crime, vice, you know, drugs, nightlife, you know, sort of the fear mongering, like.
Black musicians, but not black patrons.
Oh, correct. Yeah.
Clutch your pearls and keep a hold of your daughters. Kind of like.
Right. Yeah. Know, everything that goes with that.
And all of that, like the vilification of lives. You know, our stickers say music is not a crime, and that's why people sometimes are like, why do you have to say that in a sticker? And I'm like, you'd be amazed,
right?
How frequently it is criminalized.
I think, you know, I just want to say before we close that also these things are fixable. Right, these are not intractable things that are just gonna just have to be. We can go through the code and create, you know, policies and procedures, you know, whether via law, via zoning, just via city policy that are really supportive of the culture. If we want to do it, we can. And the city's had success, you know, in the past decade with the way they've treated, you know, the masking Indians, with the way they've treated second lines. Those things have gotten better, and that was through, you know, community efforts to push and people in government understanding it, getting on board and helping. And we can fix anything we've talked about today. You know, that's why partly, you know, the cultural fund is an exciting opportunity that may be able to actually get some traction and really address some of these things we talk about. You know, it's good. You know, we're happy it's happening. You know, we're glad to see it. Thankful for people that are pushing it in government, and let's make sure it's a reality and make sure it works. And let's fix these problems. We don't want to be out here, you know, rabble-rousing. We just want to get things done and do it right and get support to the people that need it, that really deserve it, that have been, what does Renard say? They're underappreciated and underprivileged, underpaid. Mm-hmm. Let's get them that money. Let's get them that appreciation, because, you know, think of it as, you know, payment, if nothing else, think of it as payment for services already rendered, right? Let's just get them the money they deserve. Let's get them the support they deserve.
Yeah, some kind of pension stipend, or, you know, in some way for musicians and culture bearers who are aging, because there's an entire generation that's, you know, sort of aging out of working, you know, really being able to work and whatnot. I mean, just anything, like recognizing that providing stability for cultural people is really important.
It's the fabric of our existence here.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, you guys, one more time, Ethan or Hannah, either one of you. How do we find Macno again online and Facebook?
Sure. We are at macno.com, MACCNO.com, Facebook at Macno Page, Twitter and Instagram at musicculture504. You can also email us.
504.
Yep, 504. Thank you. if you can't figure it, like that, yes.
I'm just
saying. You know, you never know. And then also you can email us at mailings@macno.com. We're active on social media. We respond. We will get back to you, you know, easily within a day.
Awesome. Thank you very much, you guys.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
We'll do it again. Will you guys come back?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool. We can't speak for Renard. He's not here, but we'll make him come back too. Right. Friends, we're going to take a brief musical interlude, and I'll be back with my parting shot.
All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. I do appreciate it, as always. Great conversation there with Hannah, Ethan, and Renard from Macno. I appreciate their time and their insight, as well as their passion. A very fine organization. Be sure to go check them out and lend them support. And we'll keep in touch with them. We were kicking around some ideas of some other things we can talk about down the road on the show, and it will certainly be great to have them back on. Quick programming note for you, friends. Next week, we are kicking off the 2020 edition of our French Quarter Fest series. And that series, of course, is something we've been doing for a little while. We've partnered with our good friends there at French Quarter Festival, the finest music festival on the planet, along with our friends at Louisiana Music Factory, the finest record store on the planet. That's where we tape the interviews. And if you listen to the series, you already know. But if not, what we do is we get two or three musicians who perform at the festival. And we get them there at Louisiana Music Factory. We talk about their music, of course, and then we also talk about food and drink. And certainly we talk about the French Quarter Fest series and all kinds of other topics, interesting stuff about perpetuating music, our music culture in the area, the generational aspect of it, so on and so forth. And we have two great guests to restart the series this year for us, the fine clarinetist Evan Christopher, and the terrific Dominican Republic musician who has not too long ago moved here to New Orleans, primarily a guitar player, Fermin Ceballos. Great conversation, so be on the lookout for that next week. Friends, this is our parting shot, and part of the conversation today got me thinking about several things. I hope it got you thinking about lots of things. And one of them really, you know, we were talking a lot about how people who generate the culture in the area don't necessarily see the benefits. They don't see the Benjamins, if you will, from the effort. And certainly this is a tricky subject. And we were talking about, say, photography, where somebody profits from an image of a Mardi Gras Indian or a musician or something like that, but that person doesn't receive the benefits, and the photographer or the book or the publication is receiving the financial benefits. And as I said, it's a tricky question. Not going to unpack that here. But what popped into my head is a conversation that I hear a lot with different people around town, and it happens really everywhere, is this sort of idea of exposure or good exposure. And this is also a really tricky question. And what I mean is, very often someone will tell you, well, hey, if you do this for free or you do this for a discounted rate, it'll be good exposure for you. Somebody else will hire you at your regular rate, or it'll get your name out there, or things like that. And I know it happens across all industries, especially a lot of creative industries. A lot of my musician friends in particular, make sense, right, hear this, and somebody wants them to come play their house party, some rich person or something wants them to come play, and they say, hey, well, there's going to be all kinds of other people there. You know, if you do this for free or do this for a cut rate, they'll hire you to play at their parties. There you go. Good exposure. It also happens a lot too, I know, to my friends in the hospitality industry, particularly with dining establishments, you know, restaurants, or my bartender friends or bars, saying, hey, if you come and do this event for a deal, it'll be good exposure for your restaurant, or it'll be good exposure for you as a bartender, and then others will turn around and hire you for their private events. Believe it or not, yeah, sure, it's probably hard to believe, but it actually happens to me sometimes too. I get people that will ask me to moderate something like a panel discussion or something like that. And, you know, it takes a certain amount of expertise to be able to do things like that in the certain, you know, in my case, with a certain topic material and having some skill in doing this professionally. And people just want me to come do it for free because it'll be good exposure for me or good exposure for the show. I also get it sometimes when this happens all the time with brands or PR companies will pitch me on having somebody connected to the brand on the show because they say, oh, it's an interesting story and it'll be good for the show to have this person on. Now, sure, there's a lot of interesting stories out there. Don't get me wrong. And very often the product does have an interesting story or the distiller has an interesting story. But I try and pick and choose where those spots are. It's part of the editorial of the show. Frankly, interesting stories, especially since a lot of them are concocted, are really kind of a dime a dozen, right? And so they're really just trying to get free advertising to sell their product. Now, let me be clear. When we're talking about something like a charitable cause, you bet. I'm happy to, if it's a cause I believe in or good people trying to do something good, I'm happy to lend my time and lend my skill to something like that. I know a lot of my musician friends are. I know a lot of my restaurant and bartending friends are very much on board with helping charitable causes. So I want to be clear that I'm separating that from somebody who's paying money for a private event. So that does happen far too often when they just use the term good exposure. Now, here's what I'm going to say. If you're somebody out there and you want to hire somebody to do something and bring their skill, bring their expertise, bring their professionalism to what it is that you're doing, and all you're going to tell them is good exposure, you really better have a plan. You better have something behind it, something tangible that you're going to offer for that good exposure. Like, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. I'm not going to put ideas out there, but, you know, if you have a plan and say, well, this is what I'm going to do, maybe some pro bono kind of work. I'll do some free PR for you. I'll do something like that. That's the trade-off that I'll give you. And then if that person who, you know, the musician, the bartender, whatever we're talking about, decides that it's worthwhile, then that's absolutely great. There has to be something behind it. Don't just say good exposure. Have a plan behind what your good exposure means. Or better yet, just pay the people to do what it is that they normally get paid to do at a fair rate. And the last thing I'll say on this topic here then with the good exposure thing is if you do offer that to somebody and they turn it down, don't be offended. If they just simply ask for a fair rate for their skill, their talent, their reputation, their expertise, and what they bring to the table. Friends, that's our parting shot. Here's to you.